This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it was a week of both uplifting promises and heartbreaking systems failures. Starting in Hopkinton, still no answers in the death of 16-year-old Michaela Miller, whose body was found in the woods last month. Middlesex DA Marion Ryan says her office is on the case.
This case will not be closed until we have exhausted all avenues.
But family members and activists are expressing their pain.
My daughter was great, funny, loving, caring, and loved me to death.
And their frustration.
Pay attention to how long it took. Pay attention to the lack of response. Half of y'all didn't even know who Michaela Miller was a couple of days ago.
Kelvina Struthers, Miller's mother there, along with activist Monica Cannon Grant. Meanwhile, lawmakers search for answers in the death of 14-year-old David Almond, who died after DCF returned him to his father. A report from the state's child advocate says the agency bears the blame.
I think that DCF's failure to understand the boy's unique needs were the rationale for that poor decision-making.
All that and still a pandemic. But some promise of a brighter future? Governor Baker says finally enough vaccines for anyone who wants one.
Beginning next Monday, six of our mass vaccination sites will also offer walk-up vaccinations.
And the masks. Might it be time to hang them up? The answer, Harvard's Lenny Marcus says, depends on who you ask.
There's going to be this kind of ambivalence and ambiguity as we move out of this because it's been a very scary time and it's not clear how to move away from some of the restrictions that we've just become used to.
Lots to discuss there, so let's get to it and let's start with some of those systems failures. Listeners, do you agree that these are stories of system failures in the Commonwealth? Is there a way to ensure that no cases, no deaths ever slip through the cracks? Maybe you have your own stories of systems failure. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation with our panelists, and here they are. We have Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, and Wilnelia Rivera, Democratic strategist and founder of Rivera Consulting. Jim and Wilnelia, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Same here. Thank you.
So I do want to start with this incredibly painful story of the death of teenager Michaela Miller and calls by her family and other activists for an independent investigation. Here's the rundown. At issue seems to be three things. One, the Hopkinton police's choice to rule the death as a suicide at the outset. Two, an altercation earlier in the day between Miller and five teenagers who were white and Latinx. And three, the lack of both speed and attention to the case that those asking for the investigation call racially motivated. And we should note that Miller was Black and a member of the LGBTQ community. Wilnelia, do you agree with a call for an independent investigation?
1,000%. You know, at this point, you know, this case should have been managed a lot differently. I don't think anyone's really talking about it in that way at this point, you know, and it needs to be rectified, right? And I think that an independent investigation is what will allow ultimately all the parties to be heard the way that they need to. And it's hard when you have a community and most importantly, a family, right? And a mother that's not going to be waking up to their young daughter anymore, and they deserve this justice. And if we think that, you know, this is a moment for us as a state and as a community to really support, you know, both the Hopkinton community, but most importantly, the Miller family through what they're going through is something unspeakable. And it needs to be given the full light of day through an investigation that really builds the trust that's needed to discuss this and what happened.
I want to play two pieces of sound from Kelvina Struthers, Michaela Miller's mother. First, she says she doesn't want to feel like she has to participate in the investigation of her daughter's death just to make sure it's done right.
I don't want to have to spend all day on the phone getting and passing along evidence in order for justice to be served. What I want is for the criminal justice system to work.
Amen. And she asks for the system to treat her child like anyone in that system would treat their own. Here she is again.
I want the Hopkinton Police Department and the Millbury State Troopers Department, who are responsible for this case, and the DA to work as hard to get justice for Michaela as they would do for their own child.
Jim, how important is this level of advocacy and call for oversight to keeping a fire lit under a case that, as Michaela Miller's mother has said, garnered no public attention and felt like there was a sluggish response to her until public attention got there?
Well, I think it's extremely important. I mean, I think any parent in this situation, anybody who watches these things closely knows that if there isn't a determination made in at least a focused way, it may take a little bit of time, because in this case, the Office of the Medical Examiner takes usually up to 90 days, which frankly, I did not know before this, and I find it astoundingly long. I maybe have watched too much television where we see them with their technical instruments turning out autopsies in a day or something. But it strikes me as a really long time, kind of dragging things out to some degree. But I think it's really important, because we know that over time, law enforcement focus can dissipate. I'd just like to go back to something that Wilnelio was saying before. I believe that an independent investigation is also useful. One asterisk to it, though, I think, is this. I think Marion Ryan has, throughout her tenure, been a fairly serious person. And so I'd like to give her the benefit of the doubt and have her work through her investigation, push for this to the end until they can get the medical examination report. But I think afterwards, I think it's just good practice when there is a potentially racial motivation, potential, we don't know. But when there is one, I think it's probably not a bad idea to ask for someone else to come back in with the FBI or others to check the investigative approach and how things were done. I think it's just a good thing, also sort of like an auditing function for our local police enforcement agencies in cases where we need an additional amount of scrutiny and trust to be built in.
1-800-423-8255, listeners, to join this conversation as voters or concerned citizens, community members. What do you want to see happen next with this case? What about calls for independent investigations in cases like this, as Wilnelia and Jim have just commented on? And where does this fit in the landscape of our discussions about criminal justice and policing reform? Coming back to you, Wilnelia, I want to pick up on a couple of threads from Jim there. He picked up on your thread about... he picked up on the thread about how long it takes to get this information from the medical examiner. Here is Marion Ryan talking about how unsatisfying that wait must be for the family.
What we can do and what we really owe her is an accurate and fulsome accounting of what happened and what led to her death.
So that actually was the other piece of sound I was going to give you, which is, you know, her sense that she is called to stay on this, to Jim's second point about giving her the benefit of the doubt. She had also said that she didn't expect it to be satisfying, that saying that they're waiting for a ruling from the medical examiner is what's holding things up. How can a DA's office be responsive in a case like this, even when there's something like a 90-day wait, so that the family senses they know the urgency and they can also follow sort of the legal steps that they have to follow? What can we do better there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a few things, right? I think, first of all, we need to set up a DA's office so that they're actually also providing survivors assistance. You know, the mom of Michaela's mom said it herself, you know, she shouldn't have to be participating so closely in the investigation of her own daughter's death. Right. And what are the kinds of services that a family needs when they're going through something like this? And the fact that she didn't even get a call for, you know, whether it was 10 or 12 days, I forget what the exact number was. And the reason for the independent investigation, even while this is happening, is that it's a both and moment. You know, unfortunately, we are living in a time where the absence of accountability from so many of our police community and legal community and criminal justice community is what requires this kind of attention. So it is a both and moment. But I do think that we need to sit down with, you know, with advocates and activists, that know these solutions, that know what are the kinds of services that they would have loved or expected themselves when their own families were going through this experience and dealing with the DAs. You know, the DAs, we have one in every county, and their families and their stories like this throughout our Commonwealth. And the truth is that if we sat down with those families and we asked them, you know, what kind of services would you like at these times, I'm sure we would get a lot of answers about what that would mean.
And it was 12 days, by the way. So let's grab one call on this. And then I also want to talk about DCF and David Allman, but let's give Lisa some voice here. Lisa's calling from Peabody. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. I honestly think that it's really hard for any mother to bury their kids. nevertheless in a situation like this when she's uncertain. If that's the case of a independent investigation, so be it. Bring the FBI. We all taxpayers. We deserve to have our answers, you know, questions answered. If it was a suicide, God bless her mother and take care of their, you know, the family and friends, our prayers. But if it was something else, let's take justice. We just need to be very careful into prejudging something that we don't know. So it's a really tough situation for all the sides.
Lisa, thank you for that call. And that's a great way to wrap up the conversation about Michaela Miller, although certainly we are not wrapping up the story, and WBUR and we here at Radio Boston will continue to pay attention to it. Sadly, we have a number of systems failures cases to talk about this week, so I want to turn our attention to David Almond. This week, the Joint Committee on Children, Families, and Persons with Disabilities held a hearing in his death. He was 14 years old. His father and his father's girlfriend are being held in that death. He was DCF involved, had an intellectual developmental disability. The hearing on DCF's actions came after a damning report from the Office of the Child Advocate about massive systems failures in protecting him. Here's a little bit of sound to kick us off on this discussion. Mary McGowan of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children talking to us on Tuesday and commenting about what the report showed.
Nobody knit it together. Nobody looked at it and said, wait a minute, what is this telling us? The Department of Children and Families was, in my opinion, checking off boxes. They weren't looking at the information critically and thinking about what does that tell us about what's going on in these boys' lives? What does it tell us about the relationship between the caretakers and the kids? Nobody was looking at it critically and saying, what do we know and what do we need to do?
Jim Sturgis, that's dismaying.
Oh, it sure is. I mean, my organization did a ton of work on this after, in 2015, after, what was it, 10 deaths between 2009 and 2013. There were seven kids who died alone in 2013. And I think what's dismaying and disheartening about it is that it feels like we're hearing the very same things we heard back then. I mean, I know from conversations with folks who are in the agency that they've done a lot of work. We've spent a lot of money. We've hired a lot of people. We've changed some technology. But we're hearing some of the checklist stuff coming back all over again, kind of treating these kids as, you know, tasks. And I guess the thing that comes to mind here is that it could be, this is a one-off, but if someone's treating a kid like a checklist, it's probably likely there are more. And one of the things that comes to my mind is the state just went through a process where they had a team of employees who went through and sort of audited reviewing the cases where children were united with their parents, I don't know if extended to parent the kids who had alleged maltreatment, but frankly, every single year at a time of we don't even define. There should be an auditing function to make sure that people are always on their toes who are working that. That's tough work, and you can get numb to it. I get it. But we ought to have some function within the agency that's trying to keep the old culture, which I think Linda Spears and others have done a really good job, have tried to do a good job. We don't know yet. We'll find out. But we need to be able to beat back the old culture of treating these kids like numbers. And that's tough. I understand it, but it's got to be done.
Well, Nelia, let's hear some sound from Linda Spears, because one of the things that was interesting about the hearing was her both recognizing the failure and talking about the reform that's already happened. So let's start with her talking about the fact that the procedures and protocols just weren't followed in this case.
Every time a child is returned home, particularly kids with intellectual disabilities, there is a plan for the services, there is a plan for monitoring the reunification so that we are clear what our expectations are of our own behavior, of the family's behavior, and of the resources that are supporting that family. That did not happen in this case.
She also argued, though, at the hearing that despite the tragedy, things have improved at the agency. So here she is again.
We get, in an average year, 80 plus thousand reports of abuse and neglect. That is down, quite frankly, from where we were in 2015 and 16, when we were at 100,000, 110,000. So there's some evidence in the state that things are better for kids overall.
And Mary McGowan acknowledged both the failure and the improvements too, Wanalia. So how do we, as a community that wants to hold ourselves and our institutions accountable, stand in that tension between such a catastrophic and admitted failure in this case and the idea that perhaps we are nevertheless improving?
I mean, I think that this is a moment where, you know, I think similar like Jim said in listening to the to Linda's words, you know, the reality is that sometimes even in the spirit of things getting better, you still have moments like this where these kind of situations actually happen, right? And it also, you know, reminds me of also the fact that, you know, children and families just aren't numbers and metrics, right? They're also people that live in communities. And what could have been some of the other wraparound services that could have caught this as well, right? And I think that also is another way that, you know, I think that, you know, government is doing the best that they can at this time on issues like this, right? And I think that the issue is something that's an ongoing thing, having served in Governor Patrick's administration, and anyone that's spent any time looking at this in the last several years or decades, it's always an ongoing issue. And I think that the DCF has made a lot of progress, right? But what does it really mean to hunker down and understand how poverty is really impacting families and other issues as well? Because I do think that part of the nature of how people are living through these times, we actually don't fully understand, you know, as we're, you know, talking about the future and what this new normal might look like. We have to really actually take these moments as sobering moments for us to learn deeper lessons of what actually happened in this particular case, but most importantly, what could inform the future of future systems reform, right? It could be other solutions that aren't available to us right now. And I think that there is a, you know, DCF is taking a major role in the responsibility, you know, not just in this particular case, but at a system level, right? In terms of what's happening within the agency and overall. But I think the answer really begs over the course of this next year, how can we take this particular case and this report, you know, to really actually deepen the conversations with providers on the front lines and others to really think about what else do we need to do so that we don't have other stories like this happen?
Well, Nelia, you talked about some of the wraparound players. We've got a call, I think, that is to that point, 800-423-8255. John's on the line in Cambridge. John, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, thank you. Yes, I was curious why the discussion is framed entirely as a failure of state government. When in the Almond case, according to the report, there were six private provider agencies that were involved in this case. None of them are named in the report. None of them came up in the hearing. One of them wrote a recommendation for Almond to be reunited with his family, the recommendation that DCF relied on. The fact is that we have a public-private model for administration of child welfare and disabilities more generally in Massachusetts. The private provider agencies are never named, and there's no accountability. Why is that?
So to John's point, Jim, I do want to also add, I did some research and reading in preparation for the conversation we had about this on the show earlier this week and today. And some of the news reports also reported, and this is a little different than what John is saying, that there were organizations, nonprofits engaged with David Almond and his family who did raise concerns about the safety of him being returned to his family, and those concerns didn't penetrate. So maybe I can step back from John's piece and ask you overall about the efficacy of communication and partnership between public institutions and private institutions in a case like this, and how we think about shared accountability.
No, I completely agree. And I think that you find that within these agencies, some are really good at what they do and some are less good at what they do. And there should be a way to reduce reliance on those who aren't doing as good of a job and rely more on those who are doing a better job. And of course, there are geographical constraints around that. I get all that. But that's a matter of measurement of performance. There are some that do an incredible job. So I would also say that it would be really hard for the state to stand up all the assets they would need to do and to build the community relations that all of these various community-based organizations do. They do amazing work in many instances. This does get to a question of measurement, though. And there was one thing that one of the advocates said that really struck a chord with me. And that is Kate Lowenstein from Citizens for Juvenile Justice, where she's saying, what do you measure when we're not measuring death? And I think that's a question that we really ought to put a lot of time into, because saying that DCF is doing a good job on the basis of lack of death is not saying that DCF or the state or we as a state are doing a good job. We need to come up with proxies for well-being and aim for those. It's better to aim for really positive stuff than to aim for avoidance of bad stuff. Mm-hmm. So I get John's point. We can definitely do a better job on that. I wholeheartedly support his call for accountability of the private entities engaged in this, as well as the public entities. But I would say this, the public entities also have a piece in this, a big piece in this, because what is clear to me is that David Altman was put back into the home with his dad it was pretty fast. And if you're going to do all the work they're supposed to be doing, which includes reaching out to extended family, caseworkers, teachers, mental health professionals, all the rest, it doesn't happen that fast.
Yeah, I do want to note that he was the decision to approach for reunification with his father was actually made the day after a juvenile court determined the father was unfit. So we did have this kind of real disconnect there. I don't know about you, but I am learning a great deal from our panelists this week, Wilnelia Rivera, Democratic strategist and founder of Rivera Consulting, and Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. So let's just jump right back in. We are talking this week about a week with heartbreaking failures and hopefully some promise. Before the break, we were talking about the death of David Altman at age 14 and an investigation into DCF's role in that. And I want to come back. I want to ask one more question of the two of you, Jim and Wilnelia, on this. And then I'd like to move to the news about the Sean Ellis case this week for a minute as well. Are we expecting too much out of our child welfare system now, Jim?
We ask an awful lot of them. We ask the impossible, where we have families that have issues, and we all know it. I think we ask too much of our schools. We ask too much of our child welfare agencies. This is an issue of trying to get jobs and bringing the economy back in a lot of places, that people actually have different things to work on, pulling people out of poverty over a longer period of time. I think that what Wilnelia was saying before is the pressure of poverty, the pressure of being stuck in a place, and the frustrations takes a toll after a while. So yes, I think we are. I think anybody who knows the work they do, has looked into it, knows that that's incredibly, incredibly heart-wrenching work.
Wilnelia, do you agree?
I think how we protect the most vulnerable among us is a reflection of all of us, especially those of us that can navigate this economy or the one that's coming down the road. And it says more about what matters to us today, that these kinds of system failures are part of an ongoing narrative, right? You know, there was a time in this country where child welfare system didn't even exist. Right. And I think that we're at the crossroads of a need of another major transformation, because the kind of poverty that's embedded itself across our commonwealth takes the common out of the wealth, if you ask me. And I think it really is the role of all of us, you know, not just the state. And I want to be clear, right? Child welfare shouldn't be something that's just the role of the state. It's really about how we reimagine and re-envision how we can provide that bill of services in a way that actually gives us its value and its merit. And when I say merit, I don't mean in the sort of narrative way. What I mean is actually spending the money on it that it costs, right? And taking care of children from cradle to, you know, to college and along the way. And I think it has to be a shared value for all of us, because the truth is, and I've said this on the show many times before, we can't compete our way to having these kinds of values. We have to have a shared responsibility on it. And we can't just wait until the next, you know, bad situation to happen to make a couple calls for accountability, do a couple tweaks in the system, give people a couple more tools to do better, but yet we still find ourselves here systemically. And I think it behooves us to really think about what that means as we continue to go through the long-term recovery of this pandemic. You know, for those of us that are okay, that's, you know, we'll figure it out. But the reality is, if things were worse for these kinds of families already, imagine what it's going to be over these next couple of years.
All right, so let's turn to one more case of systemic failure in the Commonwealth this week. It's been a hard week. This is in the criminal justice system, and it's the case of Sean Ellis, who was originally convicted of killing a Boston police detective in 1993. That was overturned in 2015 due to police and prosecutorial misconduct. This week, a judge vacated his conviction for illegal firearm possession, citing the same reasons. Then Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins dropped the one remaining gun count against Ellis, ending his saga in the criminal justice system. It is hard to say that justice was served ultimately, given that he spent 22 years incarcerated. So if justice wasn't served this week, Jim, what did we accomplish?
Well, I think I have a lot of respect for Suffolk County DA Rollins on one big score, and that is if the justice system is not adhering to its rules, if there is misconduct, that we have to take that seriously, because if the justice system does not have the logic of justice, even were it to come out with the right result in the sense that they put someone away who may have done something, I'm not saying that's the case in this case. She follows a principle of if then we cannot hold that person, put that person in jail. And I completely agree with that. The justice system has to be built on a foundation of justice. Point made. So I agree with that. I think that's actually a positive thing. I feel really bad for the family, the Mulligan family. I feel really bad for the Ellis family. And this is not a happy one.
So, Will Nelia, one of the issues here was police misconduct. And Rosemary Scapiccio is Sean Ellis's longtime attorney. She's noting that Suffolk County DA Rollins is also saying she's going to look at all cases involving corrupted detectives, and saying that she believes there are other innocent people in jail. Here she is.
I'm hopeful that if that investigation truly goes forward, that other people who are now sitting in a jail cell convicted of crimes they didn't commit will have the opportunity to prove their innocence and be free.
I think about that and our conversation earlier this week with Attorney General Maura Healey, where I asked her, you know, as part of law enforcement, what is your obligation to reform? DA Rollins has embraced an obligation to reform, and there's reporting that she may become the U.S. attorney, which means then the Suffolk County DA isn't the one who has embraced that obligation to reform. Are you worried about that move up? Despite, you know, if one is a supporter of DA Rollins, one would be glad to have her in the U.S. Attorney's office. Are you worried about a loss of that push for reform in Suffolk County?
No, I think that, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself in terms of where Suffolk County DA Rollins may end up, but I think what's clear is that she's brought a new era to the Suffolk County, you know, legal system, right? And what we need to really make sure, you know, in real time is what are the ways in which what she's built under in her administration so far, how can it be sustained, right? Because ultimately, if she were to move on to that, to the federal role, you know, we would, you know, someone would have to get appointed, but then there'd have to be an election ultimately. And I think that this is the importance of activism and advocacy to ensure that what she's already put forward doesn't disappear. And the reality is, it's not just about looking at the past, you know, cases of perhaps police mishandling of different cases. It's also looking at things that are happening in real time, right? Because at the end of the day, there's actual police corruption that's happening in BPD in real time. And there's a lot of, there's hundreds and thousands, if not thousands, of families in this community that have been trapped, you know, for generations, you know, in this system between the Suffolk DA's office and BP in the Boston Public and BPD, Boston Police Department. So I think that this is not something that's going to go away just because, you know, if for some reason or another DA Rollins were to move on in her role, and this is not something the community is going to back down from.
Okay, so I'm going to shift gears now. We started this whole show today talking about the fact that this was a week of failures in our systems, but also potential promise, and that's around the pandemic. So I want to turn our attention there first. Now, it's interesting because I'm talking about potential promise, but we're going to start by saying, what about the failed promise of herd immunity? I guess I'm just Debbie Downer today, so sorry about that. But listeners, we want to get your thoughts on several things in the pandemic, and let's start with this question of, can we even get to herd immunity? Do you think it should be the goal? Can we get there? This is a change in messaging, those who are now saying that we can't. What's your reaction to that? And if that's not the goal, what is now? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I want to start us off with some sound from Dr. Cassandra Pierre of the Boston Medical Center. She was in our Ask the Doctors on Tuesday, and my very first question was if herd immunity was ever actually possible.
Well, at some point, it did seem like it would be attainable when we thought that we needed maybe 60 to 70% of people to be vaccinated to attain it. Those margins and those numbers changed, as you mentioned, with variants that made the virus more highly transmissible. It was a beautiful thing to look forward to, but unfortunately, the patterns of infection and the uneven distribution of this vaccine has really imperiled, not completely eradicated that dream.
Jim Sturgis, woof. I mean, what do you think when you hear her say that?
It hasn't changed anything in my mind, sincerely. Yeah, I mean, I've always thought of when people talked about herd immunity, they weren't talking about it's going to go away completely. I always thought about it as we will have pockets of this that we have to deal with on a continuing basis, but it will not debilitate every aspect of our lives. And that getting to a 70% vaccination rate, would allow us to do just that. I think that's probably still the case, because most vaccinations, right, we know they're 50 to 60% efficacious. And in this case, we've got, in some cases, 90 and 95% efficacy, which means that the vaccination rate that's necessary for herd immunity in other instances is probably a little bit lower. So it doesn't change anything in my mind. I think we should continue to aim to get as many people vaccinated as possible. And we should do what we're doing right now is making that pivot to community-based centers to make sure that we're getting into a sustainable pattern of distribution, because this will not just be this year. We'll have to have booster shots and all that sort of stuff going forward. All stuff that I hate, you hate, we all hate.
So, Will Nelia, before I turn to you, the calls are streaming in now. So I'm just going to grab a call and then I'll come to you. 1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation about the promise of herd immunity, the next phase in vaccination. What comes next for us in this pandemic? We've got Sarah on the line in Braintree. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi. I'm just wondering how valid my anxieties are surrounding, you know, we as Massachusetts are doing so well with vaccinations and everything, and we're starting to open back up, and that's great for the economy. But if some new variant that is not agreeable with the vaccine comes along, are we not setting ourselves up to be ripped through and let more black and brown people die at the hands of just wanting to have fun?
Thanks for the call, Sarah. Will Nelia. So I'm going to turn to you to react to Sarah's question.
I mean, the reality is that, you know, as a country and as a Commonwealth, we made a choice a long time ago that we were going to live with COVID, right? You know, when you look at, you know, the early window to reach, you know, to really stamp out the transmission rates, we've learned from countries like New Zealand and what they had to do in order to build that kind of infrastructure. We missed the window, we missed the boat, but I do think, you know, I am with you in terms of the caller. You know, I think that even as we make this shift to a more localized approach, which, you know, I was a fan of obviously from the very, very beginning, even with the sort of scaled approach out that we ended up with, you know, in the last, you know, few months. I do think that it's going to be an ongoing issue, right? And I think that what's important is that we can't fall asleep on the wheel just because we see that, you know, some parts of the state are doing okay. And the truth is that from a perspective of equity, especially for people of color, right? And other vulnerable, you know, vulnerable populations, this is going to be something that's going to be, it's going to be ongoing, right? And we just, again, just can't think that we're all okay because we have these nice data points that say that we can reach 70%, because it's, again, it's a statewide issue, right? And we got to get into the pockets, but not just think that in 2 years from now, when we reach a magical number, that it's going to go away. Just like the, you know, HIV AIDS, you know, pandemic, it's still a disease that we still have to manage, and it still flares up in particular pockets in other communities, and that disproportionately impacts Black and Brown communities as well. So I think that it's something that we have to continue to maintain a vigilance on. And, you know, and the truth is that, even beyond that, I think there's also a place of individual responsibility in the sense of what are the shifts in behavior that we also, all of us have to probably think through individually of what it means to live in this kind of society as well, right? And that also means in terms of when do you wear masks or not wear masks, even if you're fully vaccinated, because of the reality of like what we're still living through. So just wanted to say that too.
Yeah, I do want to get to masks, but as soon as we start talking about masks, we are going to be all in on masks because we've done that a couple of times this week. So let me go back, and I want to stay with the vaccination parts that you just talked about, Wilnelia. You made that reference to us going to a more localized approach. Here is Governor Baker at a daily COVID press briefing this week announcing that ramping down of some of the mass vaccination sites and a transfer to a more localized approach. Here he is.
And now that vaccines are becoming more widely available, we're shifting our efforts to focus on more targeted community-based outreach. Four of the state's mass vaccination sites will ramp down later in June. The sites will stay open to make sure that everyone who got their first dose can come back and get a second.
So, Jim, how much of that shift is about mission accomplished with the first wave, you know, with those who really wanted shots? And how much is this shift about we have to convince them for the next two waves, those who are in no hurry and those who don't want shots at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about the latter. I think it's about getting to people who may be hesitant or may not want the shots at all, or maybe have not been able to get to the mass vaccination sites as readily. We may not have been able to do what they were doing before, where you had to register, make an appointment. If you had a job, could you actually get to the appointment? Did you have the transportation to get there? I mean, there's a lot of things that made mass vaccination sites only one part of a larger strategy. I do think that the other piece of this is, I think I've been amazed that we didn't choose to go the community route earlier simply because it was utilization of schools and other infrastructure we already had in place, especially after we learned that Pfizer and Moderna could be maintained in regular freezers, not highly specialized freezers, for up to 2 weeks, which made that a viable option. I was surprised we didn't do this before. I mean, it seemed like a lot of asset moving around to get to the mass vaccination site delivery system. So I'm glad we're doing it now, but I do think it's really about getting to, if you will, the last mile folks, and making sure that we're getting to folks, communities that maybe we have not been able to reach, who certainly weren't last mile folks. They were just not reached as well as they should have been.
Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, and Wilnelia Rivera, Democratic strategist and founder of Rivera Consulting. We are talking about the promise of the future in the pandemic, our changes in vaccine strategy, changes in outdoor masking policy, changes in behavior, and what we want from each other, deserve from each other, and how that coincides with the science. 1-800-423-8255 to join that conversation. I'm going to start us right off with a call. We've got John on the line in Wellesley. John, go ahead.
Hello. I think it's a multifaceted approach, and it's time to extend the olive branch and really start to address and really talk about these valid logical concerns, you know, such as no FDA approval, no long-term testing, no fertility testing, no animal testing, and, you know, a 99.98% survival rate. I don't know. It's time to really talk about those and just really start the conversation off with the concerns. Thank you.
Thanks for that, John. And I want to add to John's call two other voices, and I'll turn to you. One, this is Mary, who called about her own vaccine hesitancy in our Ask the Doctors on Tuesday.
Yeah, I haven't gotten the vaccine yet because I'm leery of it, because I had an adverse reaction to an MRI contrast to gadolinium. So do you think you can convince me to get the vaccine?
And then we had another caller who said that he was concerned that we were prioritizing those who were afraid of the illness over those who had what he felt were legitimate concerns about the vaccine, given the amount of long-term unknowns. Jim Sturgis, how do we grapple both with our responsibilities to each other to keep each other safe and the pressure there to be vaccinated in order to do that, with what we do know are unknowns about both the long-term impacts of the disease and of the vaccines that we are using to fight that disease?
So I thought we were going to talk about masks, and I thought that would be a hard question. Now you're talking about vaccinations. Thanks so much.
look, all for you, Jim.
Well, look, you know, you know me. I like this old-fashioned idea of liberty. So I think people should do what they want to do. And that's where I start and probably where I end to some degree. In the middle, there's this thing called society and caring for others and being respectful. And this is true on vaccinations and masks. I think people, my mom's 87. She was really, she wanted to wait until she saw more details on it. She wasn't anti-vax. She's saying, I need more information, Jim. I really need more information. And I respect that. I think the thing is we have practical decisions to make. And I'll tell you, just in our own workplace, we will be going back to work on June 15th. And people have high levels of flexibility to come in, not come in. We're lucky to be able to do that. But if people are in the office and they're not vaccinated, they certainly will have to abide by certain rules. And that is they'll have to wear a mask. They'll have to make sure they're 3 feet apart from other people. We want to make sure we make everyone comfortable. And I think that's I don't want to bring it down to little old pioneers four walls, but that's in a microcosm, I think, the way we have to handle this more broadly, which is in private settings and public settings, use of public assets like the trains and all the rest. People are probably going to have to continue to wear things to make sure that other people are really comfortable.
So I'm going to add another caller voice here from a conversation we had yesterday about the relationship between social pressure, what we know from the science, and our mask usage behavior. This is Jeffrey calling, saying that because we've had two administrations handle this pandemic and the safety messaging so differently, it's become political, and we need to pick our eyes up and look at something bigger than that.
It's sad that a year into something that has caused 500,000 people to die, that we're still questioning whether or not we want to save our lives. This is bad. This is not okay. I don't think it's fine that we are having this conversation still right now. I'm not trying to judge anybody or anything like that, but you would think that, you know, a little more sense of actually seeing death would just tell you know what, is this fake or not, man? Let me just save myself from whatever it is that's occurring. We're just throwing caution to the wind.
Have our political views, the political pressures, our political signaling put a gate in our minds, Wilnelia, that have people taking care of each other and themselves less than we might otherwise?
I mean, I think it's a combination of both, right? And, you know, I believe in managed liberty in the sense that we have to put guardrails on it. And yes, there's a degree to which everyone has to be given a journey to make a decision about when and how they want to be vaccinated or use of other or PPE and other measures. But the reality is that we still need to have certain rules of engagement in the public commons. I wish that we can just live by the honor system, that if you tell me you're vaccinated and you walk into a public space, that I can believe you. But that's, you know, it's too many of us, and it's just unrealistic, right? You know, right now we're living in a state where we have yet to receive our full college age population back in our public and private universities. What does it mean when all these students come back? Does it mean, is the state responsible or the private colleges responsible or just the public ones, right? These are all these questions that will end up coming up, and we will have to really get ahead of them and get off this euphoria that all of us are just going to go back to a normal. The normal is one that we're actually building as we go, and we need to think through what the rules are and what of the rules of engagement are for that managed liberty to take place, so that this, you know, this on the on, not just the ongoing death, because at the end of the day, it's not just the body counts, right? It's the aftermath of what all of this has created for all of us, and that will continue, right? When in certain parts of the state, when people are still suffering from these matters and other issues, right? So I do think that it's about managed liberty, and that we have to think through what are the rules of engagement, so that we're sending a clear message, you know, from a public health perspective and from a public safety perspective. What are the expectations of all of us? Because it just can't be based on the honor system.
So I want to leave time for hubbubs, and in the rule of back and forth, that means back to you, Jim. So you're going to have last word on this. And my question to you is, when is the moment that we know in your mind that it is time for government to step back and for people, for policy to get out of it and for personal to behavior to become the way that we make our way through this?
Gosh, what a great question. That would take a whole show. But the short version is this. I think when we find that the rate of infection is low and consistently low, not just low for a day, not low for a week, and when we see the death rate really low, and when we see that the ICU numbers to the place where we find that that's absolutely manageable and good, that it's sort of normal like before. The numbers somewhat align with what we're living with before. And I would say this, I do think we can trust, especially in Massachusetts, we can trust each other. I'm a great believer that educating people is, the whole thing is trying to educate them to be citizens more than to be great in the workplace. Citizenship is a great thing. And I think we have a lot of that. We just don't pay attention. There are outliers, but I think we can handle this. I think by the time we're in June, we'll be in a pretty good shape. The government will not be able to step back completely, have to be there because we will have pockets. But I think I'm pretty optimistic, honestly. I think we're going to be in pretty good shape. We'll have issues to deal with. We have to keep our eyes on it and make sure it doesn't flare up again.
Well, as I said before, I learned a great deal from the two of you today. I appreciate it. Now I want to leave a little time for our hubbubs, which are those local stories that caught our attention this week. Well, Nelia, what you got?
So my hubbub's in the category of the unfair, but also ridiculous, which is the, you know, a former Mass pizza shop owner from Beverly, Mass, actually allegedly misused his PPP funds. He fraudulently said that he had 50 employees and really only had 10. And he took the $650,000 to buy an alpaca farm in Vermont and get himself two classic vehicles, as well as hosting his own podcast show focused on cryptocurrency.
Oh, my goodness. And as you said to me off air, you can't make that one up. All right, Jim, what's yours?
Mine's pretty aligned with one of the stories we were talking about before. It's a story of big corruption that's been percolating for a while. It's a story of the two drug lab technicians, Annie Duke in 2012 and Sonia Farak in 2013, whose misconduct affected the convictions of so many. Thousands of convictions have recently been vacated. More will be. And I think the attorney generals and the inspector general's offices have lost some sparkle, if you will, through this process. The IG still hasn't admitted that they hadn't properly investigated the misconduct. And my hubbub is essentially, I think the wheels of justice are creaking along. And a shout out again to the Superior Court and also to Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, who's declared that the Suffolk County convictions related to the Hinton Laboratory will all be questioned. And last week, she just convened DAs from around the state, prosecutors, legal professionals, to say, let's figure a way through this mess that was created by that corruption. I think that's a good thing. It's a story that has not been all over the newspapers.
All right. Well, at that, we are going to wrap it up for today. That is Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, and Wilnelia Rivera, Democratic strategist and founder of Rivera Consulting. Hey, thanks to both of you for reviewing the week with us today.
Thank you.
It's good to be with
you. Great to have you both. And listeners, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and some help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening this week. Thanks for calling this week. Have a great weekend. And then join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.